Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the Turkish coup edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, the history and future of Turkish democracy in the light of the recent coup attempt. Let's begin episode 350.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Dawn, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's show, we're going to be taking a look at the coup attempt in Turkey and its aftermath. It's been one of those subjects that I've left to mature before jumping in and running the risk of getting something wrong. Before we get into the coup itself, we should first cover a bit of recent history in Turkey. Well, no, let's go back to the fall of the Ottoman Empire and the emergence from its ashes, the modern Republic of Turkey. At the end of World War I, the Allies actually attempted to prop up the Ottoman state. I use the word state and not empire because there wasn't much left of the empire after the colonial powers had their way. Although Istanbul was to remain the capital of the Ottoman Empire, the actual territory that would be controlled by the government was a rump state, leaving only a remnant territory in the center of Anatolia, or what history books would call Asia Minor. That is, although technically most of Anatolian Peninsula was Ottoman, large sections were designated influence zones for the Italians, the Greek, the French, and the British. Even Istanbul itself was under international control. Think League of Nations, the beta version of the UN founded after World War I. In exchange for conceding to the Allies' demands, the Sultanate and Sultan Mehmet VI was allowed to remain control of the Ottoman state. This led to a kind of weird phenomenon arising in the Ottoman state. Well, weird in the Ottoman context. That is nationalism. You see, the Ottoman Empire, like the Austro-Hungarian Empire, were very different than other global empires of the day. The British, the French, the German, Spanish, American empires were very nationalistic. And the feeling, we Brits are the best and we deserve to rule the world, or things along that line. Americans refer to this as manifest destiny. That there is something innate or slightly divine, inevitable about the people of the colonial power that made them better than those of other nations that they conquered and colonized. They could do this because their homeland was, well, one people. Britain was British. France was French. Germany was inhabited by the Germans. However, the Ottomans, and as its name implied, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, were cosmopolitan. These nations were made up of many different nationalities, ethnicities, religious groups. These empires were not held together by nationalism, but a loyalty to the crown. This is why Germany, even though defeated, still exists today, but the Ottoman and Austrian-Hungarian empires quickly disbanded when the crown lost its legitimacy. Not to complicate matters, but, and I only add this to clarify what happens later on, the Ottoman Empire was also a theocracy. Sharia law was the law of the land, although there was a parallel secular legal system called Kunun. The empire was also a caliphate, the caliphate. And to be fair, there were at the time two other contenders. The caliphate is a state whose ruler is the successor to Muhammad, the holy leader of all Muslims, and thus, this was in a religious sense the most Muslim of Muslim states, theoretically. So beyond loyalty to the Sultan, you also had a layer of loyalty to the faith as sort of a secondary adhesive to this cosmopolitan empire. Getting back to the Ottoman state post-World War I, with the Allies taking such advantage with the Sultan and having stripped the Ottoman Empire of its ethnic diversity, the modern states of Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Israel, Jordan, Cyprus, Qatar, and others were stripped from the Ottoman control. and given to the Allied colonial powers, thus reducing the ethnic makeup of the rump Ottoman state. The now Turkish majority began to feel oppressed. But it wasn't just that. They began to develop a nationalistic identity as Turks, and the reputation of the Ottoman name went from proud historic empire to puppet dog of the West. This led to the Turkish War of Independence, which saw a militia gather strength out of nowhere to become a national army, and in turn taking on the Greeks, Armenians, French, British, and Italians, and founding a new nation, and by the end of which, in 1923, the Republic of Turkey was established, with Mustafa Kemal Atatürk as its first president. Atatürk in Turkey has the same mythological equivalence George Washington has to Americans, perhaps more so because his legacy is far more relevant to now. His essence is more recent and thus more tangible, a mythological figure your father or grandfather would have seen and maybe knew in their lifetime. Although Atatürk died in 1938, it remains today against the law to insult his memory or destroy or deface artifacts representing him, such as statues, plaques, and there are a lot of them throughout Turkey. Maybe more than just a George Washington, but a George Washington and Abraham Lincoln combined. In that mindset, Atatürk revolutionized Turkey, pun slightly intended. The aim of his reforms were to westernize and modernize Turkey, to take it from the, quote, feeble old man of Europe to a vibrant, modern state. Atatürk reformed politics, education, and the legal system, even going so far as to enact social reforms. As an example, he replaced the alphabet. Wow, if that's not fundamental reform, what is? He switched from the archaic Ottoman script based basically on Arabic to a new Turkish script based on the Latin alphabet. He oversaw the moving of the capital of Turkey from Istanbul to Ankara. He transformed Turkey from being an autocratic, theocratic caliphate to a representative constitutional democracy. He also emphasized the idea that the Turkish government, if not the people, would be very secular, another break with the theocratic past of the Ottoman Empire. He removed all religious imagery, religious tests, and the like from government. He wasn't an atheist, I think, but he definitely believed in the idea of separation of mosque and state, if only to reinforce democracy and remove the potential rival to elected officials vis-a-vis power. He did see the Quran was translated and widely published in Turkey, so again, a bit of a mixed message there. And to put it into sort of a contrast with America, where the founding fathers were religious, but understood that religion should play no role in governing the states. However, in the U.S. context, to prevent the state from dictating a religion on the people. But in the Turkish context, it was to prevent the mosque from dictating government onto the state, or onto the people. A quick side note here. Although Atatürk wanted to transform Turkey into a multi-party state, that didn't actually happen until about two decades later, after the nation's rebirth. And it's not like a communist state where only one party was allowed to run. No, the one reason that there was this lack of other parties, remaining a reason really until the current millennium, is that the opposition parties were not allowed to form due to the insistence on secularism. That is, any new party could not have any religious affiliation or connection. When in 1930 the Liberal Republican Party was formed and then dissolved, in part because of its efforts to roll back Atatürk's reforms, including secularization. It is a coincidence that those people who would have provided an opposition to the Republican People's Party Atatürk created were conservative. And a lot of conservative people in Turkey are also religious people. And one plank of their opposition to the ruling party is an insistence on secularism. Thus, any opposition party would have, as part of its platform, would have religion in the public or political sphere, thus making it de facto illegal as a political party. In fact, it wasn't until the end of World War II that Turkey finally realized Atatürk's dream of a Western-type multi-party democracy when in 1945 the Democratic Development Party and the Democratic Party of Turkey were established, the latter being the primary governing force in the 1950s until, well, more on that later. Back to the reforms of Atatürk. The aristocracy, as it was in the Ottoman Empire, was abolished. All were considered equal to the state, and this included women, which saw the repeal of polygamy laws, the establishment of women's right to vote and hold office, and allowing for equality in the workplace. He abolished Sharia law and replaced it with a civil code based on Switzerland's and a penal code based on Italy's. Education was completely reformed and made universally available, including, to build on the previous, that girls received the same education as boys. He enacted land reform that weakened the landed aristocracy and empowered the agricultural laborers, who could now aspire to own the land they labored on. He nationalized key sectors of the economy, including tobacco, a big thing in the day, the railway, the National Bank, and others, to ensure a stable Turkey. Oh yes, and apparently he outlawed fez. You know, that flat-topped conical red hat with the little black tassel on the top? Previously the national headdress? Why? Who knows? Likely the historical link to the Ottomans. Perhaps that explains why you never see Shriners in Turkey. These reforms are seen as the foundation of the modern state of Turkey. But unlike the US, where Washington is recognized as an important historical figure, he didn't actually create the US. There was Congress, the Constitution. However, in Turkey, Ataturk is seen as the great man of history. That is, Turkey has a certain reverence for strong leaders who hold command and get things done, in the interest of the state, of course. This reinforces a concept of governance where the citizens of the country place a dictator in charge, who will then run as a benevolent ruler. Although Ataturk removed the Sultan, he did not remove the ethos of a strong ruler. In some ways, Ataturk replaced the Sultan. As your supreme ruler, I'm commanding you to take a small break. We will return.
An enabled FM chip in your smartphone can make the difference in an emergency situation by allowing you to still hear critical updates. It will also let you listen to the local FM station using 3 times less battery and 20 times less data than streaming. Visit freeradioonmyphone.ca to see how you can get involved by contacting your carrier and signing our petition.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM, your benevolent dictatorship of skepticism. And we're back. Another legacy, and the justification of numerous military coups, was the upholding of Kemalism, or, as I read somewhere and pronounced, Ataturkulik, spoken, of course, as any true Canadian would with his accent. There are 6 fundamental pillars to this ideology: republicanism, popularism, nationalism, secularism, statism, and reformism. A lot of isms. The principles came to be recognized as unchangeable and sacrosanct, and more on that later. There's another important legacy of Ataturk. Let us remember he came to power as the head of a military coup. And with this concept in mind, in an American context, think checks and balances, the military was seen as arbiter of the government, protector of democracy. If they, the army, perceived the elected government was not living up to the ideals of Ataturk, if they were becoming too religious, too socialist, if they were violating the Constitution, if they were not serving in the best interests of the state, they would swoop in, as in take over, and reset the secular democratic system. This is something that's happened a number of times in Turkish history. In 1960, the military deposed the elected government, stating that it, the military, was restoring law and order to the nation, order that the elected government was unable to provide. Now this, the 1950s and the 60s, was a time of social turmoil and economic hardship. As money from the US dried up, think the Marshall Plan, officially the European Recovery Program, or ERP, an American initiative of aid to assist in the rebuilding of Western European economies after the end of World War II, and from a Cold War perspective, to help support Turkey and Greece, who were seen as being on the front line with the war on the dreaded commies. Anyway, as this source of funding dried up, the Turkish economy took a nosedive, especially as Turkey was forced by the International Monetary Fund to devalue the Turkish lira and instill austerity measures. And although this made it possible for Turkey to obtain loans from foreign lenders, it also made everyday life for the Turks hard, as in high inflation rates, reduction in social services. There were shortages of critical goods. I might add a deja vu here with that last bit. I mean, modern Greece with the cure is worse than the disease with regards to austerity. Just saying. The democratic government at the time, who tried to deal with the poverty in the rural areas vis-a-vis land reform, were also talking to the Soviets as an alternative source of loans. This seemed to be a no-go zone for the US-trained, US-influenced Turkish military. So they took over the state. No communism allowed. Now, to be fair, the quote, Democratic Party of Turkey, the victim of the coup, was becoming increasingly autocratic. There was, in the end, heavy censorship of the press, reporters being arrested and locked up. The economy sucked. The opposition was suppressed, both within the party and in the nation in general. As part of the coup, there was a purge. In this purge, 235 generals and more than 3,000 commissioned officers were forced to retire. Over 500 judges and public prosecutors were ejected, as well as the expulsion of 1,400 university faculty members. The prime minister at the time was executed, as were two other ministers. The president and four others in the government were sentenced to life imprisonment. The Democratic Party of Turkey itself was suppressed, as in ceased to exist. Now, returning to my original theme, one might say that republicanism and populism seem to run counter to a democratic coup. But each coup was not seen as an attempt to replace the democratically elected government with a military dictatorship, but more as a reset on democracy. That democracy, left to its own devices, will, on occasion, run counter to its own aims, counter to the good of the people, to the stability of the nation. And thus, the army will step in, hit the reset button, then, having saved democracy from itself, fade into the background, ever vigilant. In 1971, another coup, this was dubbed the coup by memorandum, because no coup actually happened. It was all, quote, "Dear Prime Minister, you had better do this or we, the army, will remove you and take over." Okay, to play fair, let's set the stage. First off, to set the context that will be important later, Turkey is a member of NATO. The U.S. sees Turkey, right next to the Soviet Union, Russia in today's geography, of paramount strategic importance to the U.S. of A. in its Cold War battles. Remember, Turkey has U.S. nuclear bombs on its soil, just in case. In fact, those bombs were a major reason the American and Soviets didn't go to war over Cuba. The Soviets withdrew bombs from Cuba, and the Americans withdrew theirs from Turkey. From my research, I can't be sure when the bombs returned to Turkey, but currently Turkey holds a little less than 100 American nukes. By the end of the 1960s, Turkey's economy was again in the dumps. But this time the Turkish people had seen that there was an alternative to the capitalist model, communism and the Soviet model. More and more, the left were taking matters into their own hands and attempting to spur revolution. The left carried out bombing attacks, robberies, and kidnappings. From the end of 1968, and increasingly during 69 and 70, left-wing violence was matched and surpassed by the violence of the far right. The far right groups were also often very Islamic. Remember, there were two things the military were to protect the republic from. One was communism, the threat from the left. The other, religion, the threat from the right. And both sides were seen as threatening the democratic secular state. The government at the time was splintered, bringing the legislative process to a halt, far worse than what you see south of the border between Obama and the Republican Party. There was violence and anarchy in the streets. By January 1971, Turkey appeared to be in a state of chaos. Critics of the government were being bombed by neo-fascist militants. The Islamic movement had become more aggressive, and its party, the National Order Party, openly rejected Ataturk and Kemalism. The government at the time, weakened by defections, seemed paralyzed, powerless to curb campus or street violence, unable to pass serious legislation on social and financial reforms that were needed. All this seemed to the army to threaten the very existential existence of the Republic of Turkey. It was time, once again, for the military to activate its role as protector of democracy and provide a reset on the state of Turkey. It was in this context that the military, in an almost anticlimactic way, presented to the government a memorandum. A memorandum really amounting to an ultimatum. It demanded, and I shall quote here, "the formation, within the context of democratic principles, of a strong and credible government, which will neutralize the current anarchic state, and which, inspired by Ataturk's views, will implement the reformist laws envisioned by the Constitution, putting an end to the anarchy, fratricidal strife, and social and economic unrest. If these demands are not met, the army would exercise its constitutional duty and take over power itself." The government resigned 3 hours later. I have endeavored to explain, to this point, why the army took over, but to be fair, it had a tad more complexity than has been revealed so far. While the precise reason for the intervention remains disputed, there were three broad motivations behind the memorandum. First, senior commanders believed the prime minister had lost his grip on power and was unable to deal with the rising public disorder and political terrorism, so they wished to return order to Turkey. Second, many officers had been unwilling to bear responsibility for the government's violent measures. More radical members believed coercion alone could not stop popular unrest and Marxist revolutionary movements. Finally, a minority of senior officers concluded that progress within a liberal democratic system was impossible, and that authoritarianism would result in a more egalitarian, independent, and quote, modern Turkey. Other officers felt that they had to intervene, if only to forestall this authoritarian radicalism. Now, to be fair, authoritarianism is not compatible with Kemalism, but national stability trumps all. Now, unlike the 1960s coup, the aftermath of this coup was not clean. A new wave of terror began and perpetrated by the Turkish People's Liberation Army. Martial law was declared in 11 of 67 provinces. After the Israeli consul was abducted on the 17th of May 1971, hundreds of students, young academics, writers, trade unionists, and the Worker Party activists, not just leftists, but also people with liberal progressive sympathies, were detained and tortured. For the next 2 years, repression continued, with martial law renewed every 2 months. Constitutional reforms repealed some of the essential liberal fragments of the 1961 Constitution and allowed the government to withdraw fundamental rights in the case of, quote, abuse. By the summer of 73, the military-backed regime had achieved most of its political goals. The Constitution was amended so as to strengthen the state against civil society. Special courts were in place to deal with all forms of dissent quickly and ruthlessly. The universities, a primary source of leftist activity, had lost their autonomy. The radicalism of student faculty were suppressed. Radio, television, newspaper, and constitutional courts were curtailed. The National Security Council was made more powerful. And once the Workers' Party was dissolved in 71, trade unions were pacified and were left in an ideological vacuum, i.e., you can represent the workers so long as you don't do anything to rock the boat. There was a crackdown on the Islamist National Order Party in an effort to appear even-handed vis-a-vis left and right crackdown. However, the neo-fascist National Action Party was left alone. Seems that even the ideals of the military can be political. That said, ultimately the coup of 1971 failed where the previous coup succeeded. As the 1970s rolled on, the violence and political turmoil continued. At the start of the 80s, Turkey was in an unstable situation with unsolved economic and social problems, widespread labor unrest, and politically in a state of paralysis. The Grand National Assembly of Turkey wasn't even able to elect a president. As it turns out, a military coup does not necessarily cure all the ills of a nation. In fact, the failure of the 70s coup directly led to the 80s coup. To hit the democratic reset button, the army planned a coup that was to put an end to the social conflicts of the 70s, as well as the parliamentary instability. On September 12, 1980, the National Security Council, i.e. the army, declared a coup d'etat on national television. Martial law was extended throughout the country. Parliament and the government was abolished. The constitution was suspended. All political parties and trade unions were banned. They invoked the Kemalist tradition of state secularism and unity of the nation, which had already been justified the previous coups, and presented themselves as opposition to communism, fascism, and religious sectarianism. Where this coup differed from the other was in scale. Sure, the previous coup was violent and repressive, but they didn't actually do anything to address the causes of the social and political unrest. The 1980s coup did a complete overhaul of society. During 1980 and 1983, the foreign exchange rate was allowed to flow freely. Foreign investment was encouraged. Land reform and economic development was pushed forward. Government froze wages and a deflationary policy was pursued, including currency devaluation. All this meant that the economy was in much better and stable state by the time the army was willing to allow civilian control to return. The generals passed some 800 laws in order to form a militarily disciplined society. They decided to adopt a new constitution that included mechanisms to prevent what they saw as impediments to a functioning democracy. That said, martial law was declared across the country. Hundreds of thousands of people were detained. Among the detainees, 230,000 people were tried, 14,000 were stripped of their citizenship, and hundreds of people were sentenced to death. Over 1.5 million people were blacklisted. Tens of thousands of them were fired from their jobs. It was in no way a peaceful coup. It was a very violent one, maybe more so than the previous coup. It was, however, more thorough. Ergo, one might say, in an odious way, that this coup is more effective at achieving its goals than the previous coup had been. As control returned to the elected officials, Turkey was once again a de facto one-party state, with the Motherland Party, or ANAP, as the only party running until 1987. However, with the exception of a minor period, the ANAP was the governing party until 1999. I said, with the exception of one minor period. Well, in 1996, the Workers' Party managed to pull together a coalition that ousted the ANAP. That is, they were in power for barely a year and a half when the army set another memorandum. This time, they didn't dissolve parliament or suspend the constitution, but simply forced the resignation of the then prime minister, Nikmeddin Erbakan. Because of the relatively peaceful nature of this coup, it's been dubbed the postmodern coup. This set, in one way, a very important precedent. The other coups were instigated because of political and or economic unrest. This time the army cited, as the cause of the coup, this government's support for religious policies deemed dangerous to Turkey's secular nature. The military banned the Workers' Party and appointed the ANAP leader as prime minister, who managed to form a coalition, and the ANAP were back in power. Okay, now that we've got the distinct history done, we're going to take a break and explain and explore the recent turn of events. We'll be right back.
Would you like to get updates on your smartphone in an emergency, even if a cell tower is down? It is possible if the FM chip is activated in your phone. Visit freeradioonmyphone.ca to see how you can get involved by contacting your carrier and signing our petition.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM Vancouver, Canada, your secular broadcast defending skepticism in the face of sectarianism. And we're back. Okay, are you still with me? That was a long background, but here are our takeaways. First, the army is seen as protector of the state, of democracy. Yes, I know a coup and military dictatorship is the opposite of democracy, but in many societies it is seen as a necessary evil to protect the greater good. The people in these society trust the military, and each time the army directly controls the state, it was very limited, unlike a classic military dictatorship. We see that the Turkish state is secular and capitalistic, that only a limited amount of social upheaval or protest will be tolerated, and that repeatedly it has been necessary for a strong man to take over the state to save the state, as in Ataturk. Now this seems to have changed in the new millennium. After a series of economic shocks, the 2002 election saw the surprise victory of the newly formed Justice and Development Party, which is referred to as the AK Party or as AKP. I say surprising because it was formed out of the remnants of the Welfare Party. That was the party that was banned in the 1997 coup for its religious leanings. Its leader, Recep Erdogan, yes, the one current president of Turkey, was at one time banned from politics for reading a nationalist and Islamic poem at a public function he attended as mayor. On that basis, the Turkish prosecutor tried to close or ban the party just prior to the elections. Coincidentally, at the time, Turkey was, and to be fair, still are, trying to join the EU. Yes, that EU the UK just voted to leave, and not in no small part because of the possibility Turkey would join. What a small world we live in. Anyway, under pressure from European nations who thought Erdogan's banning was kind of anti-free speech, his ban was rescinded. The party won its first election in 2002. In fact, it won big, taking over two-thirds of the seat, a feat not accomplished in over a decade in Turkey. Although toning down his Islamist leanings in the lead-up to the election, once in power, a purge of sort occurred. Hundreds of secular officers and their civilian allies were jailed. By 2012, the old secular guard in positions of authority were replaced by members and supporters of the AKP. After the 2002 elections, Turkey's economy improved greatly. Inflation had dropped to a manageable 8.8%, and the party's been in power ever since. There were some rocky roads, though. In April 14, 27, an estimated 300,000 people marched in Ankara to protest the possible candidacy of Erdogan in the 27 presidential elections, afraid that if elected as president, he would alter the secular nature of the Turkish state. This was followed by other protests across the country, some of them numbering over a million participants. You see, the longer the AKP has been in power, and in particular Erdogan, has been leader of Turkey, the more religion has been seeping into the Turkish politics and the state itself. In 2007, elections were delayed after opposition parties boycotted the parliamentary vote and deadlocked the electoral process for president, at the time elected by parliament and not by popular vote. Erdogan blamed the political impasse on the Turkish political system and proposed to modify the constitution. When elections, running under the banner "No Stopping, Pushing On," were eventually held, the AKP won 341 of the 550 seats, and Erdogan remained prime minister, giving him a mandate to push forward his constitutional amendments. Amendments did things like the presidency was elected by popular vote and not by parliament, changed some term limits, the timing of elections, and reduced quorum by about half. Previously, of the 550 members of parliament, at least 365 had to be present to pass a law. That was reduced to 184. Or put another way, you needed to have two-thirds present to pass a law, and now it was only one-third. After doing that, once again, Turkey's chief prosecutor, a new prosecutor, tried to have the party banned for violating the principles of separation of religion and the state of Turkey. The case was decided by a constitutional court of Turkey, which has banned many parties previously over such charges. This time, though, they didn't ban the party. However, the ruling did show a greatly increased tolerance for religion in politics, and a major blow to the ideas of a secular state. First, the vote was actually 6-5 for closure or banning. But under Turkish law, there had to be at least 7 votes for closure. Also, in a 10-1 decision, the judges did agree that the AKP had become, quote, a center for anti-secular activities, and cut their public funding in half. Again, I think joining the EU played an important role here, as the EU was not a big fan of banning political parties. One EU parliamentarian went so far as to say, quote, everybody is very happy with this decision. Otherwise, it would have created a hell of a situation for Turkey. After the global meltdown of 2008, the AKP lost ground in the 2009 elections, but still remained the dominant political party. This followed with more constitutional reforms in 2010, of which the opposition says these changes made the judiciary more dependent and less independent of the government. Perhaps the biggest change in the secular nature of Turkey can be seen in the evolution of the Diyanet, or Presidency of Religious Affairs. Think of it as the Department of Religion, which was established by Ataturk as a way to control and contain religion, i.e. the mosques. Its role has changed much under Erdogan's tenure. For one, it's had its budget quadrupled to over $2 billion by 2015, making its budget allocation 40 times greater than the Ministry of Interior's, and equal to those of the Foreign Affairs, Energy, and Culture Tourism Ministries combined. Its role has also changed from a means of ensuring government control over the mosque to, as one official put it, a supersized government bureaucracy for the promotion of Sunni Islam. It has also increased the number of religious laws, or fatwas, it's been issuing, forbidding things like feeding dogs at home, celebrating the Western New Year, lotteries, tattoos. Although a government agency, these fatwas or laws are not legally binding. Another criticism put forward is that the AK party is using the Diyanet, and by extension the mosque, as a way to promote the party and ensure its remarkable electoral success in spite of growing opposition. So that may explain why Turkey keeps electing both the AKP and Erdogan. And on that mystery solved, let's take another break.
How do you listen to CITR? Do you stream it with your data? You could be getting it free on your phone with the already installed FM receiver chip, but major carriers have blocked access to it. If you want access to all your favorite CITR goodness on your phone, get involved. Visit freeradiomyphone.ca to see how you can get involved by contacting your carrier and signing our petition.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker, a skeptical broadcast that's not dependent on its electoral success from mosque, church, or synagogue. And we're back. And now we come to the events that occurred a couple of months ago, the failed military coup. So why did the military feel the need to remove Erdogan? First is the erosion of the secular nature of Turkey. We have already talked about the Diyanet, and how Erdogan has used this institution to promote Islam and integrate Islam within the state. The Speaker of Parliament said at a conference, secularism would have no place in the new constitution, as Turkey is, quote, a Muslim country, so should have a religious constitution. This flies in the face of Ataturk and the secular nature, the military at least, deems as an essential part of the Turkish Republic. So it is no small stretch to see why the army would see the need to remove Erdogan. But there's more. The increasing diminution of the military and the blatant attempts from the perspective of the military, of Erdogan's humiliating domination of the armed forces. They would point to, from their perspective, the fake coup of 2010, the constant erosion of powers, the use of the judiciary to undermine and remove military leadership. Some actions as simple as Erdogan promoting lower-ranked officers up the chain of command, ensuring that military chiefs of staff were loyal to him, thereby demoralizing the army. There was a growing case of rampant corruption within the Turkish government, with the quashing of litigation in the gold for gas scandal of 2013, when it implicated a member of Erdogan's family and family members of the cabinet. At the time, Erdogan and the government spun this as a plot by the judiciary to sort of form a coup of its own against the government. The army saw through this and could see the political spin. They saw that the government suffered from corruption, and another role the military embodied was the removal of corrupt governments and the restoration of legal democracy. Now, those are seen as the prime triggers of the coup. That said, there's been a growing case to be made that Erdogan is turning Turkey into his own dictatorship. He's been using his power and position not only to replace key elements in the institutions of the nation, but simultaneously suppress the opposition, and not just suppress, but of undertaking an active campaign of humiliation and legal entanglement. For example, a posting of a photo by a Turkish man comparing Erdogan to Gollum, yes, Lord of the Rings Gollum, is considered a state crime and an attempt to undermine the government. Evidence of Erdogan's intolerance of criticism. He has waged a war against media and the journalism. Any article critical of Erdogan or the government is equated to terrorism. If you report on corruption or similar, you are just as vulnerable to be arrested for treason or espionage. In December 2014, the Turkish police arrested Erkem Dumali, the editor of Zuma, the country's largest newspaper, a paper that has written extensively about the corruption that pervades Erdogan's government and family. The arrest took place under an accusation of attempt to mount a coup d'etat. Roughly 1,800 journalists, politicians, and ordinary citizens have been charged with, quote, insulting the presidency. This includes a 14-year-old who made a post on Facebook. One note of importance that will be more evident later on. While Erdogan was president, it was deemed the most powerful position in the nation. However, after being forced to retire from that office due to term limits in the Constitution, limits that Erdogan had tried to get removed, he was then elected to the presidency, which strangely is now the most powerful position in Turkey, something he hopes to make permanent with more constitutional changes. So the president of Turkey is required to be neutral and independent of partisan politics. It's part of the oath of office. Breaking the presidential oath of office is a violation of the Constitution of Turkey. The opposition accused Erdogan of breaking the terms of office by being openly partisan in his dealings with the AKP. In February 2015, Erdogan was widely condemned by the opposition for calling out people to vote for his party in the upcoming elections. There are also issues less grand that have struck a chord with the populace of Turkey. First is the presidential palace. Perhaps upset that he couldn't change the constitution to allow a fourth term as prime minister, Erdogan saw a new home as a consolation prize. He oversaw the construction of a new palace called Akasera, Turkish meaning white palace. So no, the use of the term palace is not an invention of his critics to cast his home as opulent. He was going for Ottoman-style luxury all along. Oh yes, and the official cost is about $400 million. Not that anyone knows the actual cost, as this Turkish state-owned housing development administration refuses to divulge the construction costs on the grounds that releasing the information could hurt Turkey's economy. That said, the Turkish Chamber of Architects estimate the building cost to actually be over 2 billion Canadian. The palace occupies approximately 15 acres of land in Ataturk Forest Farm in Ankara. It is probably telling that the farm is also the home of a replica of Ataturk's home. Image and product placement is everything. Oh yeah, and did I mention that it was ruled illegal by the Turkish courts to build on the protected land of the reserve? I guess the laws don't apply to someone like Erdogan. Another curious observation that a number of critics of Erdogan have put forward is the re-Ottomanization of Turkey. First, the increasing role of religion as part of the state. The return of the Sultanate, or well as many, and I would probably count myself among them, in the efforts of Erdogan to turn the presidency, if not into a Sultanate, then at least into an absolute power of the state. And then, of course, there's the pageantry. Many observers have noted that more and more references to the Ottoman Empire has arisen in Turkish politics. Gulen, once a strong supporter of Erdogan, promoted the Ottoman mind. It is a classic dictator rhetoric to cast back to a glorious time when the Turks, as the Ottomans, controlled most of the Mediterranean, when they mattered in world politics. Will you get my point? And taking the previous point into consideration, there seems to be a number of reasons in support of a coup against Erdogan. There have been claims that the recent coup was actually a false flag operation orchestrated by Erdogan to strengthen his control over the state. Now, before we address the possibilities this coup was set up by Erdogan, we need to discuss a previously failed coup in 2010 called the Sledgehammer Plot. These coups have such great names, don't they? So why is the Sledgehammer Plot important? Well, first, word of it surfaced when documents were leaked to the liberal Tarafa newspaper. Documents that later turned out to be supplied by a member of the Gulen movement. That name sounds familiar because it's the same movement, and more specifically, the founder/leader Fethullah Gulen, that Erdogan has accused of planning and promoting the most recent coup. As a result of this apparent uncovering of a coup attempt, hundreds of people were arrested, largely in the military. This included approximately 50 high-ranking admirals, generals, and colonels. This attack, as it was seen by the military, resulted in the chief of the Turkish armed forces resigning, along with the Army, Navy, and Air Force heads in protest of jailing military officers. Then Prime Minister Erdogan accepted the resignation and appointed new military leaders. This decision stamped the civilian authority on the country's military, which we said has long been regarded as protector of Turkey's democratic secular state. As one columnist of the day put it, this is effectively the end of the military's role in Turkish democracy. This is a symbolic movement where the first Turkish Republic ends and the second Republic begins. Now, where this gets interesting and will help shed some context to the most recent coup attempt is, well, it seems, if not all, parts of the 2010 coup were completely fabricated. Signatures of key military leaders on the plot documents were forged. The original Sledgehammer documents, claimed to have been produced in 2003, were actually created using Microsoft Word 2007. There was also a lot of comments that there may have been early planning for a coup upon the election of AKP in 2002, but there was currently no coup planned in 2010. Some saw this as a way of Erdogan, via the judiciary, to remove the military from the political landscape, for Erdogan to consolidate his position and concentrate more power in his hands. And once again, it's important to bring up the tie-in with Gulen, who was, until a fallout in 2013, a close ally and confidant of Erdogan. The Gulen movement, referred to as Kemet by outsiders and Hazmat by themselves, is an Islamic transnational religious and social movement led by the Turkish preacher Gulen. He has created an empire of charter schools around the world, but also in Turkey. He promotes humanitarian aid, has a notable media empire, but more specifically, he is tapped into Turkey's aspirational middle class. As such, he has a large number of followers in the judiciary, civil servants, and other professionals. This has led calls that Gulen's movement has formed a parallel state, that by using its members embedded into state institutions, it has managed to undercut and manipulate courts to accomplish the end of the military's political power. That it has, as part of its alliance with Erdogan, systematically used the media, courts, and other forms of the state, as well as social pressure, to destroy all opposition to Erdogan. Some have accused Gulen as creating a religio-political cult. Gulen promotes, quote, an Ottoman empire of the mind. Specifically, what is meant by that, I don't know. The source, Gulen's own website, seems to have pulled that article before I could actually analyze it. Perhaps some of the fallout of the recent events. So in 2010, Gulen and Erdogan are best buds. Someone from the Gulen movement seems to have framed the military and perhaps used the movement's followers in the media and judiciary to effectively neuter the army, removing it from the political landscape. In 2013, a corruption scandal hit Turkey. This time, it was Erdogan who was in the center of action. 52 people were detained in the gas for gold scheme where a loophole allowed Iranian gas and oil to be traded for gold or something. The details are unimportant. What is important is that among the almost 100 people implicated were a number of family members of cabinet ministers, the head of the central bank, and Erdogan's own son. How did the government act? How did Erdogan react? First, to stop the arrest. Erdogan's son was to be part of a second round of arrests. Coincidentally, the police officers in Istanbul Security Directorate, who happened to be newly appointed by the government just a few days previously, refused to carry out the order. The deputy director of public prosecutions didn't approve this new operation. In fact, within a month of the first arrest, 350 police officers were removed from their position, including the chief of the unit dealing with financial crime, smuggling, and organized crime. Essentially, those people who dared to bring Erdogan and his ilk to justice suddenly found themselves without a job. This is when Gulen and Erdogan parted ways and became mortal enemies, with Gulen describing the decree as a purge of civil servants, where Erdogan described the corruption investigation as a judicial coup by those jealous of his success and backed by foreigners. Now, it should be noted that from the U.S. Statement Department and otherwise reports, the corruption was very real. The gas for gold was a real scandal. So it seems the claims of nepotism, hints of dictatorship, are actually valid. So it seems there was again good cause for a coup. And there is precedent for at least the potential of a manufactured coup attempt. But why would Erdogan want to instigate this coup, or at least set it in motion? First, let me step back. The term instigator or set in motion, well, what ways could this be a form of false flag operation? Well, it could be all plot. Everyone involved was following a plot. But is that tinfoil hat level of conspiracy? No, I don't think it was all a plot. Especially when you factor in what seems to be a genuine happenstance of social media to quell the coup. Not a complete plot, but what I would think of as an inspired plot. Or a beer bottle plot. That is, people loyal to Erdogan, selected members of the military who would be sympathetic to a coup, may have helped inflame anti-government sentiments, made appeals to the glorious old days, loyalty to the patriarch saint of Turkey, Ataturk, provided some ideas how a coup could be carried out, and then sat back and let things ferment. Like homemade beer in a bottle, provide enough fuel and it will pop on its own. Who knows? Maybe time will tell. Maybe this was just a coincidence that Erdogan was willing to take advantage of. But how? How could he take advantage of it? Well, first let's talk about the purge. Just one day after the coup was foiled, almost 3,000 judges were dismissed and detained. A fate also suffered by almost 70,000 other officials, as well as almost 3,000 soldiers of various ranks were arrested. Among those, at least 34 were generals or admirals. By now, as in the time of this recording, this number also now includes tens of thousands of teachers who have been suspended. Hundreds of educational institutions, mostly private ones, have been shut down. Almost 100 governors have been removed from office. Erdogan shut down TV channels, radio, printed media, numbering 128 in total, 29 of which were publishing houses, as well as pulling the press cards from 34 journalists. Beyond using this as an excuse to purge Turkey of all opposition to Erdogan and his AKP, he has also accused Gulen and his followers as primary instigators of the coup, and has dismantled every Gulen movement project, school, and supporters, even asking the U.S. to extradite Gulen, who now resides in the States, to face treason charges. There have been calls for the reinstitution of the death penalty. At the end of the day, basically this means that Erdogan has been given a great opportunity to bring about reforms that will be claimed to be protecting democracy, but will in reality cement Erdogan's hold on power. To repeat myself, this coup may be seen as the death of the Republic of Turkey and the birth of the Turkish Caliphate, or at least the Turkish Empire. Tell me what you think about what had happened, and email me at info@radiofreethinker.com. Okay, and to end the show, let's have another take on the failed coup. This is WatchMojo's 10 crucial facts you should know about the military coup in Turkey.
From violent unrest to a nationwide blame game, events in Turkey in 2016 have had the whole world watching.
We are hearing reports of hundreds of people killed and many more wounded.
We will not let this country fall into the hands of a small group of terrorists.
Number 10. What happened on the night of July 15th, 2016? Just before 11 p.m. local time, Turkish military jets were seen flying over Ankara in what the country's prime minister, Binali Yildirim, described as action, quote, taken outside the chain of command. It was the beginning of an attempt by a faction within the armed forces to seize control of Turkey and to overthrow President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Major government buildings, including the Turkish parliament and presidential palace, were damaged. Istanbul was also targeted, as the media reported the approach of tanks at Atatürk Airport and soldiers occupying Taksim Square. Over 300 people were killed as events unfolded, and more than 2,000 people were injured. After a night of tension and fighting, the coup eventually failed, with Erdogan's forces regaining control by early morning on July 16th. Number 9. What is a coup d'état? A French term that literally translates to blow or hit of state, a coup d'état is an attempt made by military or elite forces, ordinarily under state control, to overthrow a government. Also known as a putsch, a coup d'état is considered a success if the organizers obtain and retain power for at least 7 days. A so-called inside job, coups can serve to seriously destabilize governments and societies, whether they are successful or not. Coups are often the result of mounting unrest, but they can also be difficult to predict. According to reports, the scale and severity of the attempt in Turkey was largely unexpected. Examples of world leaders who assumed power via a coup include the presidents of Uganda, Chad, Mauritania, and Egypt, as well as the prime ministers of Cambodia, Fiji, and Thailand. Number 8. Who is responsible for the Turkish coup attempt? Specific details proved difficult to ascertain in the days and weeks after the July 2016 attempt. During the early stages, the breakaway group declared itself the Peace at Home Council on a state-owned news channel to broadcast a pre-prepared statement and overthrow announcement. News anchor Tijen Karash was allegedly reading the statement at gunpoint. No official statement on the group's composition has been made, but former Colonel Muharrem Kusha was arrested as a potential leader. Reports suggest that when Kusha was arrested, he was carrying a list of 37 names of potential council members. In the aftermath of the coup, at least 6,000 people were detained, including over 2,800 soldiers and over 2,700 judges. Number 7. How did the attempted coup end? At the time of the coup, President Erdogan was holidaying at the resort town of Marmaris.
That night, around 10 p.m., I got some news, and they told me about what was going on.
But by dawn, he had flown to Istanbul Airport to address supporters and report the attempt as unsuccessful to the media. Erdogan had previously communicated with the country via a FaceTime message broadcast on Turkey's CNN channel. The president called for people to take to the streets in defiance, and they appeared to do exactly that. Groups confronted military vehicles, and some laid down in front of advancing tanks, all despite the Peace at Home Council calling a curfew. The police and security services also battled back against the usurpers. Eventually, the coup plotters were overcome, as footage of some 60 soldiers surrendering control of a bridge in Istanbul was beamed to news channels worldwide. Number 6. How does this compare to past coups in Turkey? Turkey has a history of military coups, with four similar events taking place since 1960. The first in the Turkish Republic resulted in the then president and prime minister being arrested and tried for treason. In 1971, the armed forces intervened following an economic downturn. Ongoing clashes between left and right-wing groups resulted in another coup d'état in 1980, and military action forced the resignation of Turkey's prime minister in 1997. Turkey's military sees itself as a guardian of its democracy, but the events of July 2016 indicate a potentially dangerous division in the country. While those loyal to President Erdogan took to the streets in support, there are reports that the number of those against the president is quickly rising, with some analysts suggesting there's an almost 50-50 split in the country. Though the coup failed, it's expected to have ramifications for Turkey's short and long-term future. Number 5. How did the government react following the attempt? The Turkish government blamed the Gülen movement for the attempted coup, and in the aftermath, instigated a series of purges aimed at members of the civil and military services suspected of involvement. The Gülen movement is built around the Islamic theologian Fethullah Gülen, who has since condemned the violent attempt against Erdogan. At least 2,839 soldiers were arrested, including over 30 generals and admirals. 36% of all judges in Turkey were detained, and at least 7,899 police officers were suspended. The Ministry of National Education was also severely targeted, as 15,200 teachers were suspended, 21,000 teaching licenses were cancelled, and over 600 educational institutions were shut down. Disapproval for the purges has been widespread, with many groups such as Amnesty International and the EU reminding the Turkish government of its obligation towards human rights. Number 4. What is the current state of Turkey? President Erdogan quickly implemented a state of emergency, allowing the government to rule by decree. The purges appear to be the first stage in a long-term plan for the country, as Erdogan promised, quote, fresh blood in the armed forces. In the wake of what he called, quote, significant gaps and deficiencies in national intelligence, the president also said that a fresh coup attempt would be considerably more difficult to mount, as Turkey is, quote, more vigilant. Meetings with the Supreme Military Council to discuss the restructuring were scheduled, and Erdogan also indicated that the state of emergency might be lengthened. Turkey's foreign currency credit rating had suffered as a result of the putsch and purge, but Erdogan has claimed that the financial sector remains strong. He's also said that, quote, the state of emergency is not a curfew, and that people would be able to get on with daily life, despite the government's increased powers. Number 3. What are the allegations of conspiracy? In response to his being blamed by the Turkish government for the coup, Fethullah Gülen has suggested that it may have been staged by Erdogan himself in order to gain more power. Further skeptics have argued that the apparent sloppiness of the attempted overthrow could indicate a so-called false flag conspiracy, as could the rapidity with which Turkish authorities were able to detain thousands of accused perpetrators. It's also been noted that actual MPs didn't feature heavily as events unfolded, either as victims or rebels, despite the coup's apparent anti-government motives, and that the coup plotters didn't issue a list of demands. A final argument against the coup's authenticity relates to how transparent events appeared to be and how not covert the operation seemed.
As tanks took up positions at the entrance to Istanbul's airport, driving alongside cars on highways, jets and helicopters buzzing overhead.
Comparisons to 1933's Reichstag fire have since been made on social media, suggesting the attempted coup is an elaborate propaganda exercise. Number 2. What has the international response been? After the initial overthrow attempt, governments and organizations around the world called for calm. U.S. President Barack Obama urged all parties to back democracy.
We strongly reject any attempt to overthrow democracy in Turkey.
The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said that the UN was working to clarify the situation, and Russia advised its citizens in the country to stay indoors amid the uncertainty. Since the coup was quashed and the purges began, global reactions took a different line, with many world leaders issuing warnings to Erdogan. The EU called for, quote, restraint and moderation in the government's reaction. UK Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson echoed that response, and Belgium also called for, quote, proportionate action. The US Secretary of State John Kerry reiterated America's support for the elected leadership, but also voiced concern, asking for, quote, calm and stability throughout the country. Number 1. What does this mean for Turkey's future? One of the most pressing matters in the coup aftermath concerned mounting calls from Turkey for the extradition of Fethullah Gülen, who has since been living in the US in self-imposed exile. Should a formal extradition request be made, as many onlookers anticipate, then Turkey's turmoil puts even greater pressure on international relations. For the country itself, the state of emergency and the prospect that it may be extended is likely to create further tension. Though the pictures suggest that President Erdogan has the backing of the Turkish people, the president's critics argue that his post-coup actions are a consolidation of power in an already authoritarian regime. Regardless, Turkey's geopolitical significance to ongoing global affairs means that what happened in July 2016 will have repercussions for weeks, months, and potentially years afterwards.
That's all the time we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise, a morning flame.